Today and every day, the American people must make decisions on which their whole survival may depend. To make sound decisions, the people must be informed. For this, they depend on the nation's free press. How well is the nation's press doing its essential job? The people have a right to know the truth. They have a responsibility to ask. The right to question.
What about communist China? I'd have to say that when I went to school, we didn't learn very much about China. Perhaps you had the same experience. We studied about the Greeks and about the Romans and the history of Western Europe. But China, that was just a big, vague, faraway place on the other side of the world. And the idea that the United States and China would ever get into a shooting war with each other, a shooting war in which we might have trouble holding up our end, well, that idea was just unthinkable. That's why Korea came as such a shock. And it's still a shock to pick up a paper or tune in the radio and hear that we may be on the brink of war again with China. How did we ever get into such a fix? Mr. Louis Lyons, I'm addressing that question to you and your guests on this program.
To explore these questions of such tremendous importance to us, we have two of our leading authorities on China. One is Mr. Theodore White, a correspondent in China, both before the war and during the war, and author of such books as Thunder Out of China and his recent novel on China, The Mountain Road.
Mr. White says, and I quote, "The greatest unreported revolution in modern times is taking place in communist China, and the American people are almost totally ignorant about what is taking place."
Our other guest is in charge of China studies at Harvard University, and with him many of our leading China correspondents have studied, and he is the author of Modern China and the United States and China, Professor John K. Fairbank.
Professor Fairbank has stated, quote, "that questions like the diplomatic recognition of Red China or its admission to the United Nations are completely overshadowed by the problem of getting American correspondents into Red China so we can get some news out."
Our two experts then are deeply concerned about our lack of information on China. We will question them in just a moment.
The press and the people. As moderator from Harvard University, the winner of the Peabody Award for Television and Radio Journalism and the Lauterbach Award for Outstanding Contributions in the Field of Civil Liberties, Mr. Louis Lyons.
Mr. White, you've said that the American people are not getting the real news about China. Well, that's pretty close to our key problem. Then let me ask you briefly, what do we really know as newspaper readers about China? How good is what we feel we know? What has the press really been doing for us on this?
We have keyhole information on China. It's as if we had our eye to a keyhole beyond which there was a furnace. The revolution in China after the war is one of the most monstrous events of the 20th century. It's an upheaval, a Himalayan upheaval in history. We look at this revolution and these events through this keyhole. We have a scrap that we hear from the Peking propaganda radio, a scrap that's picked up by a radio in Tokyo, a clipping that manages to reach Hong Kong. And out of these fragments, we try to feel our way to a meeting with this new giant of the world, which may eventually come to war with us.
Thank you, Mr. White. Now, Mr. Fairbank, you've said that we can't make the important policy decisions about China, such as recognition, until we have got reporters into China. Won't you explain this, and why is it we can't get reporters into China?
Well, this story seems to be pretty simple, and much as I am against knocking Mr. Dulles just because he's in the focal spot of our problems, it really is his decision. He's fixed it so that we can't exchange correspondence with Red China.
Just a word as to the Dulles policy on reporters. After long pressure, Mr. Dulles finally agreed in a statement August 22, 1957, as an experiment, he said, to let those 24 newspapers and services that had foreign services send a correspondent, one each, into China, provided each would stay at least 6 months. His passport would be renewed after 7 months. In effect, then, he was there on a trial period to be reviewed by his government. And Mr. Dulles added this in that statement: it's to be understood that the United States would not accord reciprocal visas to Chinese using passports of the Chinese Communist government. Well, the outcome was that the Chinese didn't admit American correspondents. Now, we've just checked with the State Department on this, and it's still the same policy. Mr. White, what do you say to this?
Well, I think there's a fundamental folly, or worse than that, in the State Department's policy. In a way, they've accepted the underlying philosophy of the communists, that newspaper men are pawns or tools of government policy. Where I believe that we desperately need every scrap of information we can get from communist China right now. The State Department, for 5 years, forbade anybody to go to communist China, while the communists kept inviting American newspaper men. As soon as the State Department reversed itself, the communists then said, no, you can't. So that now the issue of whether we shall or shall not go becomes a matter of high policy between our government and the communist government in Peking. This is wrong.
Well, Mr. White, suppose Mr. Dulles should lift his ban. How would we be fixed then, really, to get information out of China? I recall that one of your old colleagues, Harold Isaacs, out of long experience as a Far Eastern correspondent, has said that we never did a really adequate job of reporting such a complicated place as China before the revolution. It's infinitely more complicated now, and that the real question is, have we the qualifications to do the job?
Qualifications means people. There are all sorts of things involved in that. I think that during the war, we had the finest corps of correspondents in Asia of any other country, men who had studied that country and studied it well. So dispatches weren't printed back here in the USA. Those are for other reasons which I can explain. Right now, with the exception of two or three correspondents left in the Orient, there are none who can speak Chinese if they got in, who know the country as it was before the communists took over. We would have two tremendous problems. One is, if we got in, to cover, to get beneath these veils of secrecy and mystery of the communist government. The second would be to get our stuff published in the press back here at home if we did get in.
Well, as to that second one, this really sticks in your mind as a barrier.
Yes, it does. Let's face it. let's take this. The AP churns out 20,000 words of news from overseas every day. That's about 25 columns in the daily newspaper. All the papers get it. They use about four columns. Of the four columns they use, 75% is spot news. The rest of the stuff they use is human interest stuff. But the kind of stuff you need from a dictatorship is interpretive stuff. I remember when I was in China, the communists and the Kuomintang were negotiating in those final negotiations that led to the Great Civil War. That week, the famous cold egg story broke. The Chinese had a way of chilling an egg and standing it on an end so it stood up. It caught the imagination of all the editors in the USA. Any correspondent who filed a story about the egg standing on end got bylines, got pictures, got a play across the country. If you did the difficult, important story of these negotiations that were to lead to civil war, you got maybe one paragraph down at the end. Our editors and our publishers have to sell papers and make money. The really important interpretive stuff does not pull circulation, or at least most editors feel it doesn't. They want canned, hard, spot news, or they want human interest stuff, like Mao Zedong telling people how to swim upstream. But our press has not yet learned the tremendous importance of that particular type of feature or interpretive story in a dictatorship where the government controls every channel of spot news.
And at the moment, Mr. Fairbank, with no American reporters in China, the Chinese really have a monopoly, don't they, to tell the world, and especially the Asian world, just what they want.
They not only have a monopoly, they're using it very effectively, because our not being in the game and having any view of what's going on in China leaves us subject to their propaganda, in effect.
Yes.
And we are getting their story and thinking about it as best we can without any check on it.
Well, Mr. Fairbank, I'd like to ask you, what are the things going on in China right now that we ought to be hearing about?
Well, the big story, in my view, which ought to take precedence over recognition and all this stuff we're talking about in this country, which may not be possible, big story is the communes. Now, these communes are a process of taking, say, 20,000 people, maybe 30,000, maybe 40,000 people, and putting them into a single economic unit, a thing that's never been done in the world before. Not a city. It's a combination in the countryside.
Mr. Fairbank.
Yeah.
Now, you see, I, as a newspaper man, if I got in, would like to check whether that were entirely true. This is the Potemkin village stuff that the dictatorship announces over the radio from Peking. The thing to do would be to go to those places. There still are only 18,000 miles of railway in China. We have 210,000 here. The thing to do would be to get on horseback or walk on foot up into some of these hill villages. How different are these communes from the Baojia system of Chiang Kai-shek?
Well, you might get on a non-communist horse, but you'd be talking to communists all the time. And you'd get out there in a Potemkin village, if you were a correspondent, too. I mean, this is a many-fold problem.
Well, Mr. Fairbank, some other countries do have correspondents in China, of course, and I see among the many clips we've been gathering from 40 newspapers over recent weeks about China and getting a great dearth of information, an editorial, one of the very few we found, this in the Louisville Courier Journal, and "We Learn About China from a Canadian" is the title of the editorial. This was after some articles by a Canadian correspondent. And they say we're dependent on these foreign newsmen because the State Department refuses to let our newspaper men go into China. Our dangerous lack of knowledge of China hurts us far more than it does the Chinese and their rulers. Well, let me ask you, do you feel that the American press has pressed as hard as they might against this Dulles?
Certainly not.
Well, recently...
I would disagree with Mr. Fairbank.
You disagree.
I don't think the American press has made any effort to try to break this thing.
The Newspaper Publishers Association has protested officially. The Overseas Press Club, which represents American foreign correspondents, has protested officially.
It's only very occasionally you get anything in an editorial or any newspaper that really tries to attack the problem.
Well, I suppose we might as well have it all out. They protest, but they don't protest vigorously. The State Department...
Mr. White, recently I attended the 25th anniversary meeting of the Associated Press Managing Editors Association, and one of their most distinguished and veteran editors, Roy Roberts, was there, made the final speech to them, and he said, in effect, gentlemen, it's scandalous that the American press is denied a chance to report on this vast nation of more than half a billion people and all that's going on there, and he put it up to them that it was one of the most urgent pieces of business for the American press to change that situation. They haven't changed it.
Reporters may say that, but I don't think publishers are concerned about
this
that.
The Coles brothers, who publish some of the greatest papers in the USA, have protested as hard as they can. The NPA, the National Publishers Association, has also protested. There's this slight hangover of fear. The State Department can take reprisals against you.
Well, it is against Bill Worthy right now because he was there.
It can take reprisals against much more eminent and people who appear much stronger. So if you press too hard, you're apt to get yourself into all the various mechanisms the State Department has of ruining your career for years thereafter. But insofar as we can press, we have.
Some people have.
Yeah. Do you feel that the reading public is pressing the newspapers to do something? Are they really wanting and demanding news out of China?
No, I don't. And I feel that if any politician took the lead in doing this, if someone protected by the protection of Congress or the Senate demanded that this be done.
Why not the Democratic Party?
They should. That is, if you agree with me that we cannot have a sound national policy without an electorate that understands, then it should be a cardinal political insistence that we get information out of China.
This is just elementary, and yet we have here some kind of American fear still, and refusal to face this problem that we're up against, which is going to get us if we don't face it. That's the one thing you can be sure of.
That's very interesting, Professor Fairbank. The last Gallup poll I saw showed that only about 20% of the American people are in favor of recognizing China, the great majority against, and yet right up here in Vermont, the first Democrat ever to get elected in Vermont was stumping the state in favor of recognizing Red China and ending nuclear tests.
Well,
there's very little news about that outside of Vermont.
The problem is that, you see, recognizing isn't not just a unilateral act, and it's no solution and no panacea. We can recognize unilaterally, and it won't prove a thing, possibly.
I just suggest that this man, doing the unprecedented job of getting himself elected as a Democrat, was campaigning on this issue, and it wasn't fatal to him. Now, the senior Democrats had apparently assumed it would be.
Mr. Lyons, I would not like to get this issue confused with the issue of recognition of Red China. That is a governmental matter and a State Department matter. The need of the U.S. people for information is a social matter. Whether or not we recognize Red China, our kind of country can't operate unless we understand. I can give you an instance of that if you'd like.
Please.
The most brilliant thing our State Department ever did was the Marshall Plan in Europe. This is one of the glories of American statecraft in the post-war period. It was brilliantly reported. Our people understood what we were doing. They backed the government up. Congressmen could vote for Marshall Plan aid. We won the only significant triumph over communism in the post-war period with the Marshall Plan. But where the people do not understand and they do not know, then intelligent leadership cannot lead. And that's the situation in China.
Well, for example, we can apply that right now to the Taiwan situation. We've got it into these islands on the coast of China. It's a strategically very difficult position. Personally, I think we should get out if we can, but I don't know how we can get out under fire. But this whole thing has to be dealt with, not item by item as it comes up in a crisis, but as a package, as a whole program, as a plan, including not only Taiwan, but the mainland. What you do about recognition, what do you do about an independent Taiwan, maintaining it, what do you do about admission to the United Nations, what do you do about changing correspondence? All that's got to be put into a general program which the public understand, like the Marshall Plan. I agree with you on that.
Well, Mr. Fairbank, you mentioned Taiwan. Now, as you know, we were recently on the brink of war over Quemoy. Now, things seem to have let up a little recently. But where do we stand on that? What is the danger right now in this China policy?
Well, we still have our neck stuck out in the sense that we're committed to support the offshore island position. If there should be shooting back and forth, which we couldn't keep within limits, then we'd be in a larger war than we expect. We are committed to the defense of Taiwan, which I think we have to do, but the offshore islands are a different question.
Let me ask
Mr. White, as a correspondent, former correspondent in China, do you feel that the public really knew enough about this Quemoy situation and how we got in it to judge it and to bring any effective public opinion to bear on it when it was this dangerous issue a few months ago?
None whatsoever. Let me, for example, on August the 10th of this year, our State Department made a statement which horrified me. It was tantamount to a declaration of war. I think I've got it here, I'll quote. It says, this is what we said. The United States holds the view that communism's rule in China is not permanent and that one day it will pass. By withholding diplomatic recognition from Peking, it seeks to hasten that passing. Therefore, it is announced that our government seeks to hasten the passing of the Peking regime, or in other words, that we seek to overthrow the present government of communist China. I've gone through all the clippings in 45 papers. Only four papers saw fit at all to comment that we had made any statement on China. None noticed that we had issued what in Peking could be considered a declaration of permanent hostility. This is bad reporting.
Yes, it's not only bad reporting, but it brings me to something else. Now, we say we have no reporters in China. We have reporters in Washington. We have editorial writers trying to be informed on all our newspapers. To come back to our China policy, our Quemoy policy, to what extent did either of you gentlemen who follow the score on China as much as anybody find American editorial pages discussing this issue and bringing our policy under critical scrutiny about it?
There, I think we must give pretty strong credit to our papers across the country. Papers like the Kansas City Star, the New York Times, Des Moines Register Tribune, these papers took a pretty firm, Charlotte Observer, Atlanta Constitution.
Well, that's all very well for some of those papers. I was, during that Quemoy crisis out in Colorado, and there was a paper that came out, I won't bother to name it, which had a Red Scare headline on it, One Day China Mobilizes. And so I bought that paper the next day to try to find out what happened. There was no news of China in the paper anywhere because some boy had murdered his parents or something. That was the end of the news from China.
Mr. White.
Yes.
What you have to do for me, you experts, is explain to me how China involves me. That, I think, is the critical question.
Well, I can tell you in very simple terms, our Western civilization has come up against something in Asia, a modernization of Asia, which is an entirely different civilization. And they are now modernizing in this commune system I mentioned, where people are put to work in a way that we never have done in this country. They can outproduce us if they can make this thing work. We don't know whether it's going to work yet or not, but if it does work, they've got something which is more powerful than we've got in the end, if we don't look out.
May I take a whack at answering that question, too?
Please, yes.
If you've ever pulled a dollar bill out of your pocket, you're using a Chinese invention. They were the first to have paper currency. If you've ever used a fork, you've used something that was brought from China thousands of years ago.
How about
you ever heated coal? If you ever played cards, poker, or bridge, you've been using a Chinese invention. There was something over a millennium ago in China that was brilliant, pragmatically brilliant, in a sense that had China ages ahead of Europe. We know of the Greek revolution of thought. There was a similar brilliance of thought in China 1,000 years ago. And then suddenly it froze. It became moribund. It's one of the great mysteries of history, like the decline of the Roman Empire.
Wasn't able to respond to the circumstances.
And now, suddenly, this brilliant civilization, like a sleeping volcano, erupts again. And we have to face the fact that deep in the Chinese tradition is a power of mind and a power of muscle and bicep. We must reckon with a world in which China has slept for 1,000 years, and there she is. And so many of the artifacts of our civilization are Chinese in origin, that you cannot bring yourself to believe that the Chinese won't again produce these same brilliant creations of mind and hand.
Well, Mr. Fairbank, I'm sure you must have read a recent book by our friend Harold Isaacs called Scratches on Our Minds. It might just as well have been titled Images in Our Heads. And in this, he shows how our public image of China and also India has fluctuated with the change in our national policy and foreign relations toward them. That is, from black to white or vice versa. Well, this suggests the forces that sway public opinion and put these images in our head. I'm thinking of primarily the correspondent. I suppose one might think also the editorial writer. What are his chances of writing reality and keeping to it? How uphill is it against these kinds of images?
Well, of course, we have these big swings of feeling and opinion. The correspondent has to cater to these to some extent and then put in the information that it can make a more realistic policy.
Well,
the editorial.
Let me suggest something else. Christopher Rand, one of our leading correspondents, wrote an article a little while ago about the problem of the foreign correspondent. He himself had been chiefly in China. And he said, among other things, "We Americans are really too self-centered to be detached in reporting on a foreign people. But," he said, "if a reporter really learned detachment and just reported the realities as he saw them, what was going on in this foreign country, then the man in the street would be the first to be disappointed, not to be stirred up about something. And also," he said, "the correspondent's editors would be worried about him, and they'd bring him home to be re-indoctrinated." So Rand ends up by saying, reporting probably isn't going to get much better until everything else does. Well, what do you say about this, Mr. White?
I'd agree with his conclusion. And Chris is one of the great correspondents, but I've had to work this thing from both ends of the desk, from out in the field and as an editor in New York. The American press is faced with a conundrum. It needs to give information to the people, without which the people cannot survive. Yet it has to make a profit, a dollars and cents balance sheet profit on selling this information. The natural compulsion of any editor is to publish that which gets circulation. That's his first duty to the balance sheet.
But would you say then the disinterest of the public is basically the thing?
I come to that in the...
Go ahead.
That the public, since it wants to read more about elephants getting drunk on kegs of beer overseas, or wants to read more about Mao Zedong's fourth wife, who may or may not be true, the public determines what goes into the news slots.
But what chance has the public got to be interested in something that knows nothing about, these communes of Professor Fairbanks? If nobody ever told them that there were any such things, what chance have they got to evince the kind of interest that would
encourage?
There's
emerging from this the thought that we are all of us sort of mechanical cogs in a big wheel and we can't act. Somebody in these wheels and cogs has to act. And that's the duty of the editor and the publisher.
Mr. White, why are you always blaming the public for the arguments that you reporters have with your editors?
Well, now we just blame the editor this time.
Because the editors usually agree with us, and they say that's a wonderful story, and I wish we could print it, but you know it won't sell, or it won't build circulation. Let me tell you a story. This is not about China. I was sitting in Paris, and I worked in Paris for many years. Publisher of a big Midwestern newspaper came through, spent 1 week there and discovered all sorts of stories about inflation, Algeria, crisis. And he was having dinner with the AP correspondent and chided him with never having sent these kind of stories. The AP correspondent told him that his newspaper had had one such story, an interpretive story, every single week. And the only one the publisher had published was the story of the new bikini bathing suit with the picture of the girl in the navel showing. Although he himself felt that he should be publishing that, his editors knew him better and realized that the paper needed circulation. I'm not blaming the editors. I insist that the publisher is at fault, and the publisher must take leadership in giving our country what it needs to live by and understand.
Well, actually, if you could get correspondence into China, you'd get a story out of there that would capture the imagination of the American public, whether it's menace or success or whatever it is, because something is going on there that is really epoch-making, and it's not just human interest, and it's not just inflation or abstractions. If you can get to it, you've got the human personality in China.
I want to say one more thing, because we've been criticizing the press. I honestly believe that our American press gives the best coverage of the foreign world of the press of any other country on the face of the globe. We have wonderful foreign correspondents. You can learn more about the rest of the world here than anywhere else.
Except for China.
And I say that the best isn't good enough for the kind of responsibilities we as leader of the free world must face in the future. We need to be even better than the best.
Mr. White, I'd like to ask you one last question. If you did get into China today, what would be the first story you'd look for?
I'd get on a bus or get on a horse and not go to Peking. I'd sleep at the country inns. I'd try to find out whether these communes that Mr. Fairbank is talking about are real or are phony. I'd sleep in enough hovels by the wayside and eat in enough restaurants to make an opinion and then write the story.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Well, here is one of the greatest stories in the world, largely unreported. And the tragedy is that we had, as we've been told, the finest core of correspondents on China, and they just didn't have a chance to act for us. And our foreign policy on China that we've referred to all too briefly, that led us to the brink of war, that certainly is an unexplained riddle to most of us. Well, now, hasn't the press of the most literate society on earth, with its enormous system of communication in this country, a responsibility to penetrate such an enigma on behalf of the reading public? To keep a policy so fraught with danger as this Quemoy policy surely was, under critical scrutiny. Well, when China is back again on our map of the known world, as it's bound to be, then will we be any better informed? Indeed, the question is, can we afford not to be? It's a question, of course, for our public officials who make the policy, as we've seen, whether we have reporters there or not. It's a policy for our publishers who control what is printed. It's a policy for all of our educational institutions to train and qualify men to do this exceedingly difficult job. But it is, of course, a policy for all of us. So, until next week, at this time, on the Press and the People, this is Louis Lyons.
The Press and the People. Mr. Lyons' guests today were Professor John K. Fairbank, in charge of Modern Chinese Studies, Harvard University, and noted author and former war correspondent in China, Theodore White. This program was made possible through a grant from the Fund for the Republic. Transcripts of this program are available at no charge by writing to Box 2584, Grand Central Station, New York 17, New York. Next week, the Press and the People will again examine the work of the nation's free press in informing you, the American public. The Press and the People.